About tonight, Jesse has questions prepared for the panel, but there are ways that you can participate too. If you use Twitter, you can tweet at CapTimes or using the CT Religion Vote hashtag, and I'll see those questions and can bring them up here. Otherwise, I have left note cards at all the tables, and you can write down questions, and I'll be around in about half an hour to pick those up. So without further delay, I'm going to turn it over to Jesse, who is our politics reporter at the Cap Times and has been covering this election far longer than anyone should have to. Please give her a warm welcome.
Okay, well, thanks everyone for coming tonight. I think it's going to be a fun discussion. Hopefully we will all learn a thing or two. I was kind of hoping today to come up with some sort of joke about each one of these people walking into a bar, but I thought I was probably going to be pushing my luck, so I'm just going to introduce everyone the way the night's going to go. I've got a couple broad questions I'm going to put out for everyone here to take a swing at, and a few that I'll direct sort of individually throughout the panel, and then we'll start taking your audience submitted questions part of the way through, and we'll go from there. So I'm going to make sure I get these in the right order. We've got Annie Laurie Gaylor. She's a co-founder and co-president of the Freedom from Religion Foundation, so representing our sort of secularist, non-theist part of the evening. Go ahead and applaud. That's cool. Mike Wagner is an associate professor of journalism and political science at University of Wisconsin-Madison. He studies a lot of things in the areas of political communication, but also studies religion and politics. David Smith is a pastor at Faith Community Baptist Church in Madison. Lori Zimmerman is a rabbi at Congregation Shirei Shemayim. And Masood Akhtar is an entrepreneur in the community and an advisor to Madison's Muslim community. And last but not least, R.D. McClenigan is a trained pastor at Door Creek Church here in Madison.
Oh no, I missed one! Erica Liu. Pastor at Press House. I can't see you. Alright. Hopefully that's the only hiccup we have tonight.
Well, I want to start things off. Obviously, Mike is going to be sort of our scholar here who's not going to weigh in on some of the faith-based questions, but we're going to ask him for some of the more analytical things. But for those of you who are members of a faith community or a non-faith community, as it were, like to pose a question or a set of general questions to each of you, and we'll go down the line and have you respond, and then we've got special ones for you that are not this. So for starters, it's just sort of a set of a few questions, but what is your philosophy on the intersection of faith and politics? What does your faith or your philosophy in general say about how government ought to conduct itself, what citizens should be looking for in their elected officials? And how much do these discussions happen within your faith community or within your secular community? And we can go down the line, or if anyone would like to go first, we can take them out of order, whatever you prefer.
Okay,
well,
can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Our philosophy, a secular philosophy, is in the intersection of faith and politics, is that we really think faith should stay out of politics and out of government, that it shouldn't matter what religion a political leader is if that political leader pledges fealty to our godless and secular constitution. And we were first among nations in adopting an entirely secular government, and this was done with intent, and it's a great experiment, and it's the one thing that I wish we could be more imperialistic about, nothing else in the world, because we see everywhere around us the divisiveness, warfare, bloodshed, terrorism in the name of religion and persecution of people for not being the right religion. So I agree with John F. Kennedy as the controversial Catholic candidate who said that he believed in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute. And if we honored that, it wouldn't really matter what religion the candidates are, but in fact we're very divided, of course, because of theopolitics today.
I'm sitting next to the brains. The intersection of talk about faith in politics. I think people use faith and religion so interchangeably that I see a difference in faith and religion. Religion is a broader, is what principles of what a group of people practice, and what they do, their commitment to it. And it's always looked at as either a denomination or a set of beliefs of a people. Faith is more personal. And I think people have to vote and have to support things that are personal to their own faith that might even differ from their religious body that they are a part of. So I think it comes down to having that, whatever you're supporting, and make sure it is in connection and in agreement with what your personal faith is. And again, you can line five people up that might be of the same religion, but may practice their faith differently. So I just wanted to say that to make the point.
I guess I want to start by saying that I very much believe in the separation of church and state, and that that sort of guides a lot of my thinking, and I think that's true for most of the Jewish community as well. And at the same time, the Jewish community has been very involved in politics in this country in the last century. There's a few reasons. One, religious tradition really talks about good government and getting involved and the political process. Even very early texts talk about that. I also think the historic experience of anti-Semitism has really led Jews to become involved in the political process, to work for an open and intolerant society. And being a minority makes us, you know, much more cognizant about how government functions. So these conversations are happening quite a bit in the Jewish community, and there's been quite a bit of concern about the election this year.
Okay. If I came back from India yesterday, so if I start snoring, you will know why. First of all, I would like to thank Capital Times for really organizing this very important and timely panel conversation about the topic. So we really appreciate it very much. Well, I won't have to say a whole lot because you watch that on television, what's happening in politics and what politicians are saying about the Muslim community. And I ended up writing a little article in the newspaper. I call it, Mr. Donald Trump, comma, you are fired. But you know, in this kind of environment of Islamophobia, it is very important for our community, Muslim community, to be engaged and more involved into the political process. As a Muslim community and based on our religion, Islam as well. So, however, at the same time, we as Muslims believe that whatever we are seeing on television, we should not take that, the anti-Muslim rhetoric, as a wake-up call. Rather, we should take that as an opportunity to open dialogues, engage in dialogues, and then involved into American political system or the process so our voices could be heard. At the same time, all of us in our community, and I haven't found anyone yet, that we believe that besides all of this anti-Muslim rhetoric, we believe that America is still the best country on the face of this earth to practice your religion and fulfill your dreams. And we also believe, and we should not forget, that America is a land of immigrants with different faith. And it's a general consensus that we believe that even our differences make it even better. And if we do that, if we all work together, we can really build a strong America, free of violence and extremism. So from our point of view, as far as Islam is concerned, Islam is the religion that we follow 24/7. And we have been told that if you're living in a country which is a non-Muslim or non-Islamic country, you have to follow every single rule and regulation imposed on you, and you need to respect that. And we strongly believe in that.
So the question about my personal philosophy on the intersection of faith and politics. Speaking from my perspective, I think that faith is integrated in all that I do and all I think about it, and that includes how I interact with my neighbors, with my community, and with the larger world. And so faith and politics just necessarily intersect. It's not as if there's this artificial divide. I think the people who want to put that divide often make assumptions that aren't always true. That being said, I do believe that as a person of faith, it's not my place to impose my faith upon others. We live in a pluralistic society. I am very much in agreement with Annie about not favoring a certain belief system, faith system. Just because you don't call it religious doesn't mean it's not as religious when people have ideologies and values. And that if you live in a pluralistic society, you necessarily have to come to agreement about how we're going to live together with a diverse perspective. And people are faithful, religious people with values, and you cannot separate that. And so I think sometimes we try to create this divide as if we could somehow just put off in a vacuum and we can be these objective, rational people. That's not my experience. Most people are informed and they think about the issues that are concerning facing a society from those lenses. So I think for me, you know, central to it, if I would, to summarize it, how does my how does this intersect and how do we kind of go about that? It's for me, the thinking about the most vulnerable in society, and I think there is common ground amongst many people in many different religions, but not imposing one particular agenda and identifying one particular religion or belief system is really important in a pluralistic society like the US. And so I would just, you know, take pause about what does separation of church and state mean? It means that we're not trying to impose any one particular ideology. This is a country where you do have freedom to practice whatever you believe.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I also want to say it's really an honor to be here and with my fellow panelists. And I'll answer the question about how people at my church are engaging with the political season. As a pastor, you have a front row seat to people who are all over the map on political things. In our church, we have people that support Donald Trump. We have people that can't understand people that support Donald Trump, and they sit next to each other every Sunday. And I actually think that's a beautiful thing. I wouldn't want to be at a place where everyone was the same. I don't think that's healthy or right. And so at Door Creek, we're passionate about creating a place where people feel welcomed and loved and respected, and yet we challenge each other. And I think that as the body of Christ, that really is the place where diverse groups of people come and meet at one table. And no matter what you believe or who you are, we say, come, welcome. We have an exchange of ideas. I mean, we have passionate people at our church who want us to preach about a lot of things, and we gently say, we're not going to talk about that, but we're glad that you're here, and we'd be honored to talk with you one-on-one about that. And I think the church has largely just abdicated its role as a place for people to dialogue together, in healthy, humble ways. Often the church is not humble, but loud and proud. And so we're trying to model for our people in a very divided time, and religion being a part of it. How do we love each other? How do we practice humility with those who disagree with us? How do we seek the common good so that all people can flourish in our city? A Christian believes that everyone should flourish no matter what they believe or who they are. And at Door Creek, we actually do believe that, even though we don't maybe always practice that. So that's just a little different answer to the question, but as a pastor, how we're trying to create a place for people to just know other people of other political parties and become friends. And actually, that's a pretty good first step. So there you go.
Well, we'll turn to our scholar on the panel now. What do we know this year about the candidates, their religions? How does that compare to previous elections? Are we seeing some different elements at play this year in the way that religion is influencing the political debate? How does this sort of compare to the years past?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's nice to be here, and it's really, I'm going to learn a lot tonight. This is really exciting to have a chance to be with all these folks, so this is really great for me too. How is religion playing a role in this campaign? It's very different than the past several election campaigns, where you could think back to 1988 and 1992, and you had George H.W. Bush, who was Episcopalian, and had a hard time connecting with the growing power of evangelical Christians who were also beginning to more forcefully identify as Republicans. His son, George W. Bush, would advocate for him and be a surrogate in those campaigns to kind of establish the first President Bush's religious fervor and commitment on issues that evangelicals cared about. You had then President Obama campaigning as Senator Obama in 2008, having to justify that he was a Christian as he said he was, and have opponents of his say that he identified in another religious tradition. He was kind of fighting, proving that he was a Christian, and then he had to defend the church that he attended and the reverend at that church when videos emerged of the Reverend Jeremiah Wright saying things that were newsworthy, and there was video, so it played ad nauseum on cable television throughout the 2008 campaign. In 2012, you had the first Mormon candidate for a major party running for office. And in most of these cases, President Obama excluded, people were willing to accept that the candidate's faith was what they said it was, and that it influenced their lives in particular ways. And in this campaign, we're not seeing that same situation. Donald Trump didn't have a long established tradition of living his faith, and people didn't know what it was, and there wasn't, you know, records of him living that in his life as there typically are with people who run for president of the United States. Hillary Clinton is a lot different on that score, but hasn't talked much about her faith for the most part during the campaign. And what's interesting about Trump, I think, is that very quickly, evangelical conservatives who are leaders in the evangelical community in terms of politics and evangelical religious beliefs, in terms of that connection, leaders in that community spoke up for Donald Trump and said, I've spoken to him, I see his heart, I know that he is one of us. And that's pretty remarkable. That's not something that happened for John McCain in 2008 or Mitt Romney in 2012. And we've really seen this big change, and we've seen it especially in the evangelical community, where in 2011, when evangelicals were asked in a public opinion survey, would you vote for someone who engaged in immoral behavior, 30% said that it was appropriate to do so, and 70% said that it wasn't. And in this year, 71% say that it's appropriate to do so. So there's been a big shift in the willingness of people who identify themselves as evangelical Christians and their willingness to vote for someone who engages in immoral behavior. Now, we could write that off as they're engaging in effortful reasoning to vote for Donald Trump, but we could also interpret that in terms of some evangelicals saying that supporting someone who enables immoral behavior is also something to think about. And so both candidates, who are the major party candidates for president, have something going on there, and we've seen a big shift in that particular group. Other ways that religion and politics are affecting this race deal in enthusiasm. Most religious groups who are willing to tell a survey person what faith they identify with are more engaged in this campaign than they've been in years past, and less satisfied with the candidates than they've been in years past. And that is especially true in the African-American Protestant community and in the white Catholic community. In 2012, Mitt Romney had a large advantage with white Catholics, and that advantage has evaporated for Donald Trump in 2012. And while Hillary Clinton has maintained support amongst black Protestants, her support is not at the level that President Obama's was. And so there's been some movement in those groups over the past several years.
Well, RD, I know your church is sort of more Christ-focused, more focused on kind of all denominations, well, maybe all, but you are associated with the evangelical yeah. movement. Can yes. you comment a little bit on some of that shift from evangelicals? Do you see a rift or a shift within the evangelical faith on how to approach politics?
Yes, I do. I think evangelicals are, and I'm one of them, are often painted with a really broad brush, which is unfortunate because they're very diverse. Especially, I think the big divide you see now is that younger millennial evangelical Christians are multi-ethnic. They're gospel-centered. They're passionate about justice, about climate change, about poverty, and yet also about the gospel of Jesus. And they don't see an issue between being for the unborn and also being for fighting human trafficking. Like, these are both important. Whereas in an older generation, it was really around, you know, gay marriage or abortion, those were the only issues. And in my generation, it's like, well, there are a lot of other issues that are really important. And so a lot of millennial evangelicals are not Republican, not necessarily Democrat either, but there's been kind of the religious right has come in, and what the religious right has said, that's a lot of things, but one thing they've said is they've made the political party, you know, everything. And when something becomes everything, then it basically becomes your God. And anyone who then is against that is not just someone of a different political party, but an enemy, right? And you cast them out from your presence, oh, they're not one of us, which is totally against the message of Jesus, which is inclusive and which is welcoming. And so I think that for younger evangelicals, there's a sense of very, very few are for Donald Trump, just personally. I mean, I personally hardly know anyone under the age of 30, and I know a lot of evangelical Christians who are for Donald Trump, because they say, "This, how can we support someone like this, who says things like this, who does things like this? This is totally against the gospel and against Christianity." And so they're speaking out, but oftentimes the media wants to pick out the old guard, because they say crazy things, and put them up and say, "Look what these evangelicals are crazy." And I'm like, that guy is, but he doesn't speak for everyone. We're a broad block. We love Jesus, we love people. And that's, I think, what's emerging from younger people. And it's actually very encouraging, even as often depressing as this election can be. That's an encouraging sign for evangelicals in the future of America. So I'm encouraged by that. We see a lot of those type of people in our church, which is good.
Continuing on the theme of young people, Erica, your church is very close to the UW campus. You're very focused on engaging students. What role do you see religion or faith playing in college students, young people? Are they factoring that into the way that they go to the ballot? Are they thinking about these things when they cast their vote?
Yeah, so Press House is right. Actually, we're on the UW campus, and pretty much everybody at our church is between the ages of 18 and 30. And I guess what I would say is that students don't fall that far from their apple tree. So when they come, their views generally represent their parents' views or the communities, the families that they've been a part of. And so if they came from a really Republican kind of stronghold, they tend to reflect that. What I would say, though, is that my observation is the more they have a chance to interact with people who are different, their views change. So, you know, it's not rocket science. In terms of religious, their views and things like that, they're all over the map. I think, you know, it's UW-Madison and, you know, it's just generally more liberal school, and so the demographics of our community kind of reflect that. But we have people all over who are Republican, Democrat, Green, Libertarian, or completely oblivious because they're 18 years old and just not really, I think I have to tell them what's going on in the world. So that's just part of it. And I think that there are some students who I have who are incredibly invested in the political process. They go and, you know, they are in DC and they're interning and they're at the campaign offices and out there, and they very much see that as an expression of their faith. And then there are others who are like, oh my God, we can't talk about politics, this is church. And of course, you know, it depends on who you talk to, what is defined as political. So we have the whole gamut, but my hope would be that, you know, the space we're trying to create is one which is reflective and thoughtful and engaging, and I really do agree that homogeneity is not the goal of that. We really do want, like, I hope that our community always has a mixture of people from all different political persuasions and perspectives. I think that's healthier. But it's all over the map. But I see some incredibly thoughtful people young people who identify themselves as religious, and that being a very core part of who they are, and it's why they are out there campaigning, knocking on doors, at rallies and things like that.
I've been instructed to mention that Chris Murphy is picking up audience submitted questions. Chris, where are you? Oh, he's in the back there, waving his hands. If you have any questions you'd like to ask the panelists, just give him a holler, give him a wave. All right, well, we're gonna come back to you, Amy Laurie. Sort of combined question here. We've seen for a while, it always comes out every year, you know, the polls will say voters in the US are not inclined to vote for an atheist for president, but we had Bernie Sanders this year, who is in some ways identifies that way. So my first part of the question is, do you think that sort of indicates a shift toward a willingness to look at that? And the second thing, just do you feel like people who are not religious, whether it's actively non-religious or just they don't care about that when they're voting, do you feel like they're being engaged by candidates, whether it be at the national level or even at a lower level?
Well, I don't think the candidates are trying to engage atheists and agnostics at all. We have to pinch ourselves in election years to know that we exist. And the Capital Times was very gracious to add me to the panel, but originally didn't think about including the free thought perspective. And that is because non-believers tend to be very marginalized and forgotten. We're not usually invited to be at the table. And that's because courts and media and public officials have not caught up with the changing demographics in our nation. The fastest growing segment by religious identification is non-believers, and it's been a very dramatic change in the last 10 or 15 years, to the point where more than one third of millennials identify as non-religious, and almost a quarter of the U.S. adult population, and we have surpassed Catholics. Catholicism has gone down to about 20%, and those who identify with no religion are almost 24%. That's a very significant block of people to ignore. Why would we be ignored? Why wouldn't politicians want our vote? And probably they just expect it. We're taken for granted. But it's not just that we should be wooed and courted just like the religious right, but it's also that we're constituents and we're being totally ignored. And we did a major survey of our membership last year when we had about 22,000 members, and we're bigger than that now, but we got a statistically relevant and, in fact, definitive response from 8,000 of our members. 96% of our members are registered voters. that's a lot of people to ignore. We should be a desirable segment of the population to rule. And we are very concerned about things like civil rights, abortion rights, and climate change, science education. These are our issues. And so, of course, we're very, would love to have our point of view even acknowledged, and it's very rare. You throw in a non-believers are welcome in our country too every once in a while, and that's about it. So, and of course, we're very concerned about separation of state and church. Now, Bernie Sanders obviously seems to be very secular, but when he was asked outright, are you an atheist, he denied it. He said he wasn't. So we're not quite at that point where public officials, and he may not be an atheist, in which case he should certainly not identify that way, but it's only in the last 4 years or so that a majority of the American public has even said it would consider voting for an atheist. And we've been at the bottom of the totem pole, and now I think it's socialists. So 58% of the population said they would consider voting for an atheist for president. And so we've made big headway. We're pleased about that. But I think it's still considered the kiss of death to come out as a non-believer, and there are very few out candidates or public officials. I can name them on one hand.
Well, I would like to not make this, I'm afraid to start asking the questions because I don't want to turn the whole night into a Donald Trump discussion, but there's no doubt that he has brought some interesting elements when it comes to religion in this race. So I'd like to go to Masoud first and bring up, you know, he called for a ban on Muslim immigrants until we figure out what's going on. What is that, and every sort of part of the discourse that's happened since then, what has that done to the tone of the election, and what has that done for the Muslim community?
When he made that statement, that's where things changed. And we as Muslim community, young, old, male, female, live, alive, we all decided to go against him. It caused a lot of problem in our community about the situation. Particularly, we got more worried about when our kids started coming back from school and they started saying, Dad or Mom, are we going to go back to our country if Donald Trump gets into the White House? That is the thing that started bothering us the most. A serious challenge. Then on the top of that, later on, he started talking about, you know, profiling Muslims. Okay? They started talking about going into mosques. Then he started using this information that Muslims living in the community don't inform our law enforcement officers if they do see something. It has nothing to do with reality. We all believe, everyone in this room or even outside room believe in our US Constitution that you cannot single out people living in this country, a land of opportunity that gives you freedom to speak, gives you freedom to talk about the issues, religion and everything. And yet he decided to go out and single out the Muslim community. If you look at the history, we believe Muslims are part of America. We are the lifeblood of this great nation. We are here from day one, so you cannot ignore our existence. And that started some kind of dialogue within our community that we really have to get out and start talking about making a point that we as Muslims have a common enemy, which is Islamic State, that we need to deal with together. And we have a lot more stake in that compared to anybody else. For the two simple reasons. One, ISIS is misinterpreting the religion and using that to recruit more people and kill innocent people. And second one is they're actually killing a lot more Muslims than anybody else about this. So when you have a politician who talks about the situation we are in, he talks about banning Muslims and all those things, what he's doing is basically giving more tools to these Islamic State folks or terrorists to recruit more Westerners, to recruit more people, and giving the message that West is against Islam. That's what we did when we got more engaged. Some of you attended the event that we organized in Manana Terrace on January 23rd, and our intent was, the title was, Islam, Muslims, the West, and ISIS, our common enemy. So we will continue fighting with those people, but at the same time, we want to make sure that our politicians understand that we are a part of this community. We live here, and we will continue living here. And by the way, we'll continue building our Muslim cemetery, sending a very strong message that this is our country. And we are going to live here, we're not going back home.
I will continue the Trump theme for a moment longer. And ask Lori, I mean, Donald Trump's campaign, it's tapping the support from the alt-right, which is many things, including very unabashedly anti-Semitic. How has that changed things from the Jewish community's perspective? What does that look like for you guys?
First, I'll speak personally. Before this election, I rarely talked about or even thought about anti-Semitism. It has felt very much that it's been at a real low in this country. And what Trump has done is he's tapped into all of these white nationalist, white supremacist communities that are, again, unabashedly anti-Semitic. And I mean, I never thought that I would see what I've been seeing in my lifetime. It's, you know, he's tapping into it and he's unleashing it. He retweets, you know, things. And he's, you know, his supporters are going after Jewish journalists. There's all sorts of anti-Semitic stereotypes that are old and I thought were kind of done, that he's just, you know, lifted up again. And I think our biggest concern is, not that I can speak for the whole Jewish community, but is that even if he loses the election, he's sort of let the genie out of the bottle and he's really unleashed something that's not going to go away very soon.
David, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, we've read up a little bit sort of on, you know, every religion has their conventions every year and they talk about things. Have you seen any changes in the policy priorities in the Baptist Convention and what the priorities are and when it comes to some of the more political topics?
Yes, some of the, and again, there are several Baptists conventions that vary from one thing to another as far as what they believe and what they support. The hot topics, of course, as of recent has been same-sex marriage. You know, our ministers, can they be ordained in the church? Can they be pastors of the church? That has been the big where many conventions have made recent votes to either support it or not in the Baptist conventions. And with that, and abortion has always been sort of a hot plate and a hot topic. And I think that the change that's happening is many people are waking up now and realizing that even people of faith are getting tired of religion. And I say that because we have misunderstood religion so much, and you know, because it's thrown at us, it's stuffed down our throat, and people don't really understand it, is that you follow something because somebody told you that, but your faith may tell you something different, your heart, your spirit. may tell you something different. And religion is about what a set of rules and this is what we follow or what we are told to follow. But if your faith is what you go out and do, is what you go. You don't go out and do religion, you go out and do faith. Faith is an action. You are identified by what you do, not by what you say, and maybe what's written in your laws, but you are identified by what you do. So I think that how our candidates today are, I see both of them as being very desperate and trying to sort of catch the undecided voters or those who are on the fence. They're desperately pulling everything out of the hat to try to appeal to them, and it's going to come down when people go into the polling place. They're going to identify what their faith is, not what I'm a Baptist, so I'm going to vote this way, or I'm a Catholic, I'm going to vote this way. This is who I am, and this is what I believe, and this is my conscience. And this is what the Spirit is telling me, and this is how I'm going to vote.
I'm going to make a hybrid of one of the questions I had ready for Mike and a question we've gotten from the audience. But people that we think of as religious voters or people who use religious justification for why they're supporting a candidate, is it about that, or is it about something else? Is it about tribalism? Is it about their values? Where is that coming from?
Yeah, it's really changed in the last 60 years. It used to be that thinking about the American Christian tradition in, say, the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, knowing the religious faith someone was a member of was a very good predictor of who they would vote for. And that is no longer the case. Now, a better predictor of how people vote isn't the particular faith community in which they reside or walk away from and don't believe in, but it's the level at which they believe. And so questions that survey researchers ask to try to measure this include things like, for American Christians would be questions like, is the Bible the inerrant word of God, the inspired word of God written by men, or a book of common and good lessons that people should think about as they live their lives? And people across different religious traditions will answer that question differently. And it turns out that those who answered those questions more similarly across the faith traditions are more alike in how they vote. And so evangelical Christian voters who are regular prayers and say grace before dinner and attend church regularly and believe the Bible is the inerrant word of God vote more like Catholics who believe that than Catholics vote like Catholics who don't believe those same things, or across other kinds of religious traditions in American politics. So there's been a big shift between group identity as Presbyterians or Muslims or people who are Jewish or people who are atheists, and instead intensity of beliefs across different kinds of faith perspectives. And that's been a really big change over the last 25 years. Whether that continues post Donald Trump, I think is an open question. And you know, the point about millennial evangelicals is a really interesting one. Their issue priorities are empirically different than the issue priorities of evangelicals who are north of the age of 45. The difference is that evangelicals north of 45 are far more likely to vote than millennials are. And so in a lot of groups, in the African American community, and especially amongst those who identify as Hispanic and Latino, millennials are the largest group by far, but the share they take up of the voting population is far less, given the difference in their turnout.
Well, here's an audience question, and I think that probably the best person for this one would be Annie Laurie. And the question is, given that faith often informs conscience, would exclusion of faith from politics risk excluding conscience as well?
No. No, I don't think so. Whoever asked that, conscience is the right to believe as you want without governmental interference, and that is what is protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution. And that is one of the things that the Freedom From Religion Foundation works very hard to protect, this idea that the government can't boss you around or tax you to support another kind of worship that you don't believe in, or dictate what is orthodox, or make you stand and pledge allegiance to a god. So I think that implication of that question is if you're not religious, you don't have a conscience. And we do get a lot of stereotypes and even demonization of non-religious people. But of course, atheists and agnostics do not believe that morality comes from a god in the sky from on high, or is based on threats of hellfire or rewards in an afterlife. We believe that our actions have consequences and in the natural world, and that those very natural consequences are what make things wrong or right, and that we owe our allegiance to each other. So I guess that's in defense of free thought and the conscience.
Do you guys like to weigh in on that one?
Erica, you got it. Yep.
I don't know. I feel like we're kind of mincing words because there's a lot there that I would agree with. Even your description of what religious people are, I would say that does not describe me, and I would describe myself as a religious person. So, I think there's actually more common ground that we have than not. And I guess what I would say is, though, that, we could have an hour-long discussion on parsing out what do we mean by religious and what do we mean by faith, but let's not do that. I mean, I think we use it however we want, depending on what we're trying to argue. I think the reality, though, is that people have those impulses, whatever you call it, and if you attribute it to what you see in the natural world, which I actually know many people of faith would agree with that, they would interpret differently. They wouldn't say, like, I just believe there's a man in the sky telling me what to do, or they don't believe in eternal damnation either, but they still consider themselves people of faith. So that's a part of it, and I think that we do want to be careful to protect people's right to believe different things, and that in politics, the whole point of politics is that we do live in a common society, we have to live together, we have to figure out how to do that in a civil way, and this is a part of human beings, and so, we just have to be mindful of that, and it's complex, and usually people like to put it into sound bites, which are really catchy and conflict-ridden, and, there's a lot that you say that I'm like, yeah. I agree with that.
And I would say also that there are more commonalities also than there are differences, because when you're talking about the freedom to worship and not being regulated or not being forced to worship, I mean, that's exactly what Christ taught, is that, he didn't want to force or didn't force anyone to worship. It's a liberty. You worship him because you desire, not because you're made to. And again, I think that's, again, where religion comes in, is because religion is such, this is the way you have to do it, and faith is more of it's a choice, and you're moved by your passion. You're not moved by regulation. You're moved by passion. And so I think there's more commonalities than what we can come to agreement in, more than, at least I can speak for me, what I was taught early on in my faith walk. I probably would have said no about being on a panel, and especially if I would have heard there was going to be an atheist on it. Like, oh no, I can't be in the same room. And I had a colleague said, no, I don't want to be a part of that, going to a bar. Why would I want to go to a bar? And I'm thinking, if we're Christians and we ought to let our light shine. What better place can you see a light than in darkness than going to a room of lit? You know, you go to a lit room, you can't really see your light. It's going in darkness, so. And it's real dark in here.
Our challenge is a little bit different. Because of the situation we are in right now, you know, looking at the event that any Muslim that does the terrorist act and kill people, all of a sudden, the name is associated with the religion. So if Masood does that, it's not Masood who killed so many innocent people. It's Islam that killed so many people. And that is a serious issue for us that we are going out talking to people and explaining that Islam has nothing to do with it. If you look at the US population of Muslims, we're about 1% of the US population, which is about 3.3 million people. But if you look at the worldwide population, we are about 1.6 billion to be, which is 23% of the world population. If you look at how many people of Muslims, percentage what they're doing is very, very little. And yet, the whole religion has been attacked by this politician or mainstream media or something like that. It's causing a lot of trouble for us to keep, you know, doing this kind of thing, going out and telling these people that Islam has nothing to do with what you're seeing, you know. Like any other religion, we are a religion of peace. And I think we'll continue doing that, but it's causing so many trouble in our community.
Well, we are coming up to the end of this because I promised to get everyone out of here by kickoff of Packers game. But I've got a question I'd like to pose to Mike, and then I've got a question I'd like to let everyone on the panel end with. So these are both audience submitted, but for you, Mike, first, I haven't read the article, but there was an article in the New York Times today by Nate Cohn that showed religion is playing far less of a role in partisan affiliations. We're seeing now education, gender, and income as more important variables. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think the denomination that people identify with is less of a predictor of how they vote. But the level at which they identify is still a pretty good predictor of which party people will end up supporting. And in this particular election cycle, I think we might well be masking the role that people's religious faith plays in the kinds of political decisions they might make, because there's some deep distrust amongst those for whom a more conservative faith, for those who have a more conservative faith, there's a distrust as to whether Donald Trump is a person who they can trust with the keys to the car. And yet at the same time, that same community has had a deep distrust of Hillary Clinton for decades. And so I think we're seeing we're missing some of the effects that religion might have on how people think about the decisions they make in their everyday lives because of the particular set of candidates that we have running, both of whom are very well known, both of whom are not very well liked, and neither of whom have a strong religious identity in the way that some other candidates who've run for president in the last few years have had. And we also, I think, have seen a smaller role for religious groups in public life in terms of their advocacy for candidates than we've seen in years past. And we've seen lots of different churches and mosques and synagogues doing the harder work, I think, of teaching civic skills and participatory skills within their faith communities, but we're seeing less endorsements of candidates and full-throated support of candidates and that sort of thing than I think we've seen in years past.
All right, for our last one, we'll go down the line with the rest of you, and I'm going to amend it slightly because this question, submitted one, is asking specifically about religious folks, but I think we can bring it all to all people. So how do you propose to remind people of their common humanity in the face of divisiveness and polarized discourse? Start with you, Annie Lord.
I I think the way we remind humanity of our commonality is by working to buttress that wall of separation between state and church, because we have a bumper sticker that says, protect the First Amendment, it protects you. And it shouldn't matter what our individual religious beliefs are in the United States. We're all equal under the law, we're all citizens. But we have seen a very concerted effort by organized religious right to impose its dogma on the rest of us. We are seeing a push for so-called religious liberty, the idea that civil laws don't apply to you if it offends your religion, to take away women's contraceptive right, for example. So I think that it would be nice to have more respect for the Constitution. We should have civics lessons in schools, because this is what unites us. It means we can be whatever we like, but as a nation, our government does not have a religion. It does not get involved in the business of religion. It respects our freedom of conscience.
I would say really quickly, from a political scientist's perspective, in terms of how we can deliberate together in civic life, there are three things I think that are really important. One is the willingness to listen to people on the other side. We need a heterogeneous society to make good decisions, right? When we needed some people to say, what's outside of this cave? And other people to say, maybe a saber-toothed tiger. And, you know, we need people who are willing to push the envelope and try what's next, and we need people who hold to more traditional values. And I would say that as we listen to each other, one thing I think that's important to keep in mind, and my colleague Kathy Kramer finds this in her work as she goes around and talks to people of Wisconsin, is that when we listen to each other, we come a lot farther if we try to recognize the values with which people are coming from when they're talking. It's not that the person who supports the other candidate is crazy and can't be reasoned with. It's that they value different things. And what are those different things? And why did they lead them to make this choice over that one? And I think thinking about that gets us a long way to answering that question.
I think first I'm gonna talk about the influence on politics. I think religion is having a less influence on politics, but I think faith is not. Faith is having more influence on it. How do we break down the divide? Something like that, you ask. I think we have to stop forcing people to be right or left, you know. Allow people to be politically ambidextrous, you know. Let them, sometimes I'm going to be on the right, sometimes I'm going to be on the left. It just depends on who's talking, what you're saying, and what you're standing for. And I think that, you know, when we can have honest, good conversation without judging people for what they believe. I mean, why should I feel insecure about what you believe? It's not going to affect what I believe. And why should I be insecure about how you vote? You know, if I'm a person of faith, you know, one of them is going to win. Hillary or Trump is going to win. They're both going to lose. So if that's the way it is, life goes on. Life goes on. I may not like it, but life goes on. It's not going to affect my faith.
I guess I would agree that we have to cross differences, we have to talk to each other, we have to listen to each other, even more importantly. I guess the thing that I would add is that I also think we have a responsibility to be each other's allies. So when members of the Muslim community are being attacked, or the Jewish community is being attacked, or African Americans, or Latinos, or, you know, whoever it is that we're talking about, that we are each other's allies, and that we do speak up, and we do, you know, really actively oppose any kind of bigotry or hatefulness that is, you know, being spewed. And, you know, maybe it's, you know, a Trump rally, but there's also all sorts of other issues that come up that really divide our communities. And I think that's what's so important, is that we not just speak up, but that we actually are there, and that we are really each other's allies.
I think I agree with every single thing that was said. from a Muslim community point of view, I think it's critical that we all have to work together to deal with politicians like Donald Trump alike. I think we should set up our own criteria. I think what's happening, why you are seeing the rise of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, because guys are so upset with established politicians. That's what's playing into this. What we need to do as a community is to start working together and find common ground of what we, as every single citizen, looking for it. For example, we have to look for somebody who can unite different communities rather than divide different communities. We have to find somebody who not only support 1% of people at the top and not 99% of those people. So we have to look for that kind of common ground. We have to look for people who respect the Constitution and follow it regardless of ethnicity, of color, or religion. And lastly, I will mention that we should look for those politicians who do not create an environment of fear. Rather, they create an environment of love, community building, passion, and most importantly, the respect. So my last point here, the message, is it reminds me of John F. Kennedy, what he said in his times, that not what you can, what can country do for you, but what you can do for the country. So my message to these politicians is, you should listen to that and think about this, that what you, when elected, can do for every single citizen of the United States, rather than what you can do for those who made huge donations to your campaign to get you elected.
As a person who identifies as a Christian, one of my favorite things is the sacrament of communion. Those who aren't familiar, it's about having a meal. And so what I tell my students is, whatever identity label that, you know, makes you kind of tense up when you hear, like, if it's conservative, it's liberal, it's whatever, right? Whoever that group is, that's who you need to go eat dinner with. And I really believe that. I really think, you know, if you kind of sum up scriptures, a theologian, I read this article, I thought it was a great summary. The Old Testament's like, we almost died, we survived, let's eat. The New Testament is like, you know, we screwed up, we betrayed each other, let's eat. I think there's something really powerful about sharing a meal, because that is something that is common to all humanity. And I guess in terms of breaking down walls, that is a very powerful ritual that we have. And so I think, for me, kind of the core of what I believe is that my well-being, all of our well-beings, is tied up with everybody else's, even our enemies. And until we kind of let go of this either-or paradigm, you know, zero-sum game, it's either, you know, they win or I win, if we can get out of that paradigm and that way of thinking, I think that'll go a long way. And if we just did that simple thing of eating with the people we most disagree with on a regular basis, which I don't think many of us do, that would be a powerful thing, a really powerful thing.
Three quick things. Number one, I think a robust recovery of the Imago Dei in Genesis 1, where God says that every single person is made in the image of God, no matter who you are, doesn't matter. So the Bible says every single person here is made in God's image, and that alone means that you have meaning and worth and value. Doesn't mean that if you're a Christian, you have value. Now Christians are like, they have super value to God, right? No, that's not what the Bible says. It said everyone is made in God's image. And oftentimes, especially Christians, sadly, can be on a high horse. But to say, actually, no matter who you are, you're made in God's image. And God loves you, God cares for you. And if I'm also made in God's image, then shouldn't I act in that way towards you? And so I have to recover the Imago Dei, that every single person, Muslim, Christian, gay, straight, agnostic, atheist, is valuable because of who they are, not because of what they do or what they contribute, just because they're a human being, I think would be profound. Secondly, to move beyond tolerance, to love. I think tolerance is a very, it's good. I like to think of myself as a tolerant person, but I don't just want people to tolerate me, I want them to love me. And I don't just want to tolerate people I disagree with, I want to love them and serve them. And that's much messier, which is why we stop at the fence and say, I tolerate you, but I'm not coming over for dinner, right? I just, you're too far. I think Jesus says go and says love them, serve them. They're your neighbor. Be a good neighbor to your neighbors and take care of people you disagree with. And I think that's a profound, profound thing. To love people you disagree with is really hard and difficult, especially politics. I know people's probably tonight, you know, blood is boiling just over things people say about politics because it just consumes us. And it's not healthy. It's not making us a better country. And last thing I'd say, actually, and this may not surprise people coming from an evangelical Christian, but it's grace. Christianity is built on grace. And if I'm a Christian and I say, you know what, actually, I didn't pull myself up by my bootstraps. God saved me because he wanted to, and he just loves me by his grace. And that's what he does for everyone, that I'm not going to look down on other people because I'm better or because I'm moral, right? If you live your life and say, you know what, I am moral and I am better and I am stronger because of what I've done, then you're always going to be looking down on other people because they're not good enough and they're not strong enough and they aren't like you. But if your whole life is built on grace, then everything's a gift and you can look at other people and say, I'm not better than you. And you don't have to look to politics to be your everything or your salvation. And your life doesn't have to end on November 8th, no matter who wins, right? And so I think that Imago Dei, love over tolerance and grace, and being the church where grace reigns and says that you're welcome here no matter who you are, sit next to me, and I'm glad you're here. I think that would help bring down the walls and we could love people. And I want the church to be at the forefront of that, not behind, as sometimes we have been. So that's what I'd say.
Well, with that, I think that's a good note to end on. Big thanks to everyone on this panel. I know we've got a lot of differing viewpoints here, and I appreciate you all being willing to come together to talk about this tonight. I appreciate all of you being willing to come out here and listen to what they had to say. Thanks for being a great audience. Thanks for being a great panel. And let's go watch the Packers.